This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I know what you are, Cat. You're a Hellmaiden. But it has to be our secret. That's how I can protect you.
Protect me from what?
Your demons.
Whoa! I'm having a vision!
A green-headed girl.
She seems so real.
Greetings. We are the magician mortician,
the artiste of the afterlife.
So, as your masters, we order you to turn around and,
You're tripping.
All right.
Cat's demons are raising an army of the dead.
Kingdom.
Got you.
My demons, my problem.
Good morning, RPC. Reports of my death were greatly exaggerated.
I don't do friends. Bad things happen to people I'm close to. They die.
I told them.
Wow.
This fall, and just in time for Halloween, Netflix is releasing director Henry Selick's next stop-motion movie, Wendell and Wild. The director of movies including The Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline also wrote the screenplay with Jordan Peele. The movie follows a pair of scheming demon brothers, Wendell and Wild, voiced by Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, who enlist the teen Kat Elliott, voiced by Lyric Ross, to summon them to the land of the living. The voice cast is also led by Angela Bassett as Kat's teacher, Sister Helly, Ving Rhames as Wendell and Wild's father and Lord of the Underworld, and James Hong as Father Best's headmaster at Cat School. I'm Carolyn Giardino. Welcome to the Hollywood Reporter's Behind the Screen. Henry Selick, congratulations and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm happy to be here.
So, Henry, in a recent interview you did when you were speaking at Annecy, you said, and I quote, "I believe animation isn't a genre unto itself, but a way to tell stories. For me, stop motion is the most magical way to tell stories." This is a format that you used for Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline and now Wendell and Wild. Would you elaborate on that comment?
Well, I just, I like all types of filmmaking, animation a little bit more, and then stop motion more than the other types of animation. It's just a personal preference. I like the sense of direct touch to the artist that you get. I actually like the little flaws and mistakes that are unavoidable and have really made an effort to leave those in my latest work. It's sort of proof of how the technique is used. And as far as the magic part, it's the stop motion is the oldest type of animation, well more than 100 years old, and I think it sort of like goes back to a kind of alchemy of fooling people. It's trick photography. It's requires a little effort to believe the miracle that you're seeing, and I call that magic.
So tell us a little bit about the idea and the genesis of this story.
The original story is very, very old. It was when my grown sons were little and acting somewhat demonic. I did a sketch of them as demons. George was still in diapers and Harry's a few years older. And after that, I actually wrote a story called Wendell and Wild, about seven pages. And in that story, it wasn't so much about them. I came up with a basic idea that is the movie. You know, the idea of the two demons who want to escape from the underworld and strike it rich in the land of the living, only to face Sister Helly and her sidekicks, Cat Elliot. And I put it away. It was just one of those, I was inspired. I wrote something, I put it away. And then many years later, after Coraline and after a film that I was doing for Disney and Pixar got shut down, basically John Lasseter couldn't help himself. He kept trying to Disneyfy it till the budget went through the roof. It got shut down. And I was kind of down. I wasn't sure I was going to make another movie again. But then the Key and Peele show started on Comedy Central. And it was Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele that kind of inspired me to do another film. I love what they did so much. And after three seasons of watching them, I finally realized Wendell Weil would be a perfect project to ask those guys to come in and do voices for. Turned out Jordan was interested more than that because he knew all about stop-motion animation, was a huge fan of animation, and so he wanted to come in as a producer. This is well before his first feature film, Get Out, and as a creative contributor. Ultimately, we co-wrote the screenplay. He contributed enormously to the story and tone. So it was like an old idea put away that, like, got reignited because I was so inspired by that show and those two performers.
Would you talk about how you met Jordan and how the two of you worked together?
Yeah, initially reached out to both of those performers, and they were interested, but Jordan wanted to meet right away, and then he let me know about how much he loved stop motion, and he knew about my films and so forth, and then he wanted to know, well, what's the idea? I pitched it. I loaned him the pages, and he came back and told me he really liked it. And he talked about this new production company he was setting up. There was one more season to go of Key and Peele, but he talked about Monkey Paw Productions and the sorts of films they wanted to make. And in animation, it was... he'd wanted to be part of a film that he wished he could have seen when he was a kid with someone like himself as a major character. And that was very touching and connected. And from there, we got down to business, and he convinced me to change the protagonist of Sister Helly. I had them, you know, they were Hell Maidens, but I called them Demon Dusters back then. But shift that to Cat. And you know, he made his argument why. I thought it was a good argument. And then he also convinced me that she should be a person of color. And he let me choose. And I said, well, she's got to be African-American. And that was liberating. Okay, that's our protagonist. And that sort of rippled out to the casting of the whole film. So, you know, he was very instrumental in developing the characters, their backstories, and, well, sort of this, the overall tone of the film, both how scary, how comedic, how dramatic, but also he was, like, brilliant at sort of, we didn't want to get red flags for things that didn't matter. We didn't want to make the film about race. We didn't want to make the film about the prison industrial complex that industry, even though it was important to me, mainly because of my wife's work for 10 years being an advocate for at-risk youth, that I knew about it. But that wasn't going to be what the film's about, but that was going to be anchor points. He was so good at sort of like the big picture of what might be right, what might not be. And of course, he's funny as hell. And especially when he reteamed with Keegan-Michael to do the characters, you know, we had dialogue, but then we left them lots of room to improvise.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Was there a lot of improv in those scenes?
For the first session, it was like almost all improvised because we were trying to find out just who the characters are. And you got to make room for people that talented. So they came up with many approaches and we sort of settled on one. And they would just riff and riff and riff an idea. They were very competitive in the most positive way of one-upping each other in character. There's a fair amount of improv in the final film. There was always something I needed to get done to tell the story, but then we're always wide open. I'd say probably most of the funniest lines in the film are improvised.
You just said that he dialed you back in some areas. What was the balancing act for the two of you?
Well, we just, you know, there's the what is our film? It's a comedy, horror, fantasy drama for brave children of all ages, right? Just that regular that old thing. And so, I think it was about finding a center. When you have all that swirling around, what's the center? And Kat's story became the center. And so it was, what has she faced? What has she lost? We, right up front, we got a PG rating. We asked for that in our deal because we wanted to be able to explore things a little further than most American animated films get to. So we, you know, there's a ton of animated films where the kid is an orphan or has lost a parent. There's not too many where the kid feels responsible for their parent's death. That's something new. And that was, you know, that's a tough thing to include, but we felt it was important. And so just, you know, how we did it, it's very much just a matter of degrees and adjustment that, you know, she carries a huge amount of guilt. She also, after the death of her parents, she was put in, you know, a group home school and got into trouble. She was bullied. And with the modern one strike, you're out rule of a lot of schools, she was right put into the juvie justice system at like 8 years old. And that's a real thing. We didn't want to spend too much time there. It's more background, but it's sort of, you know, it's explained in the flashback scene, you know, when she's facing her monster, her memory monster. That was just another thing to find the right balance. And ultimately, how do we free her and give her purpose, but let her parents be dead again? That's a tall order, because it would have been really false if she had brought them back and they got to stay alive. I mean, they're rotting zombies, and I don't know how much you can take of that. But I'm just sort of hitting on some of the strongest emotional elements, and you know, just finding how to balance it, that they were true and not overwhelming, and balancing it with humor and color and design. You know, balancing Kat's character with the nature of others, like Raul. He has a good feeling about her, and she doesn't really treat him very well, but he sort of has this blind faith in her right from the start that then is proven to be true. So again, it's like balancing the drama, balancing who she is as a character. You know, I got pushed a lot. I won't name names, and they're well-intentioned executives, but like, well, can't Kat smile sooner? How's anybody gonna like her? She's not smiling. And I just said, that's not who she is. She needs a really good reason to smile. And of course, the first time she smiles, it's a very small smile and laugh because Raul's tried to entertain her with his drawings of the nuns. And she gets smacked in the head immediately with an eraser for smiling. So
Overall, did you feel that Netflix gave you the creative freedom that you needed to tell this story?
Yes. I don't think there was any other home for the film that would have supported us in the way Netflix did. Right up front, they said they loved the story and us. And it was, of course, right after Jordan's huge hit film that we set it up, Get Out. But I think they were, they meant it. And that proved to be true, that they supported us throughout. We certainly had, contentious areas, and they were concerned about this, that, and the other thing, but nothing that hurt the film. It's another area that Jordan was, so good at navigating, dealing with the studio, reassuring them, and finding solutions that worked for both sides. But yeah, this is the film we wanted to make. It's not been watered down at all.
On this broader topic, you referenced the Pixar incident with your movie Shadow King, which was not made. Would you elaborate on what happened in that instance? And, you know, where are the concerns, do you think?
Yeah, what happened on the Shadow King was, it's just, how one thing leads to another to another. But I was doing the sound mix for Coraline at this place I always like to go to. Skywalker Sound. It's, the old Lucas facility, but the people are really good there, and I know them, and I'd worked with them for years. I happen to be there, and John Lasseter happened to be there. I know him. We're not friends, but I know him. I went to Cal Arts with him, and he really loved the movie, loved what he was seeing, and then they screened Coraline at Pixar, and everyone liked it, and they offered me a deal to make a stop-motion film. And it had to be for a much lower budget than the CG films. I mean, let's admit it, stop motion films have never out of the gate been as successful as the big CG films. I mean, the best stop motion films live forever, though, and as we see in Nightmare, make billions in merchandising. But so we made a deal that, I would make a film, and I pitched several ideas. It had to be for, a good budget, but compared to theirs, for this amount of money, none of their notes would be mandatory. And of the ideas I pitched, the Shadow King, which I had like a 75-page treatment and a screenplay, that's what they liked the best. But, John, it's just how all their greatest successes, they have their brain trust, and they rip things apart, they rebuild, rip things apart, rebuild. He really couldn't support my vision. He thought he could make it better. And so we kept changing and changing and changing. We'd hired a whole crew. We were actually into animation. And it was one of those things where just the budget started creeping up. And a new guy came in, Alan Horn at Disney, and they just felt, no, it's going to go off the charts for the budget because of the constant changes. And it was shut down. And it was a sad day, but it was also a huge relief because it's like taking your kid to the playground and watching your kid get beat up every day and then having to take your kid home and wipe the tears away and so forth. So it was just one of those, it really wasn't meant to be.
Do you think it's a story that will be resurrected at some point?
I got the rights back. I'll owe Disney a little bit of money if we set it up, but maybe. And I absolutely feel that it would be successful and for the right price if people just truly, if they like what I've written and want that movie rather than think they like it and then want to turn it into Toy Story 8.
I think a lot of people would like to see that movie. Let's talk about Wendell and Wild some more. In particular, I want to talk about the animation. You did the stop motion in Portland. Was it at a studio or?
Portland is the center in North America for stop motion animation.
It has become. Yes.
Yeah, it goes back to Will Vinton's studio originally. All the claymation, which became Laika, and Coraline was the first feature done there, and they've done several and. It's kind of like that's where the talent is. The winters are long and rainy, perfect stop motion weather. And yeah, we went back there. We set up a new studio. I've done it 5 times at least in my life. It's always a challenge. Then, of course, there was the pandemic, so that had a huge effect. We had to shut down for a good while. But Portland's just a great place to do stop-motion movies. You know, why do I keep doing stop-motion? And it sort of comes in and out of fashion, again and again. For me, it doesn't, but as far as how hard it is to get support for these films, it can be trying. I hope that people watch this and enjoy how obvious we've made it look like stop motion, that we didn't clean everything up. We left the seams in the faces, that replacement parts allowed the faces to emote and speak. We left a lot of little mistakes in. I'm hoping that after decades of hyper slick, perfectly done CG animation in both feature films and visual effects, that this old stuff will be refreshing and new. And, you know, I think the audience will always have to work a little more to make it real, but then it hopefully will mean more to them.
Watching it, you really do feel the hand of the artist and the craftsmanship that goes into these movies. Would you talk about the character design, which was fantastic?
I agree. Since I didn't do it, I can love it as much as you. From the get-go, I always felt that Wendell and Wilde should be caricatures of Key and Peele that resemble them. And they were not convinced, the two actors, because, you know, caricatures could be silly and, you know, big heads and tiny bodies and that sort of a thing. And I said, no, wait till you see. I have an idea. And I had reached out to this, I think, the world's greatest artistic caricaturist, Pablo Lobato. I'd known his work for years. It's almost Picasso-esque. It's beautiful design, very two-dimensional, but also, like, it captures people like nobody's business. Anyway, he happened to be coming to Los Angeles when I was going to be down there. We met for the first time. I talked about the project. He didn't know who Key and Peele were. I supplied him, you know, with imagery and then a link so he could watch some of the show. And it was great because I offered to pay him out of my own pocket. This was before it was set up, a little money, like, you know. And he said, no. I really want to be a part of this, and let me help make it happen. And after he'd done a few rounds of exploratory work, I showed some great ideas to both Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele, and they loved it. And from there, we had to kind of figure out, well, how do we adapt his style to a dimensional world? Because it's very flat and graphic. And the first thing we did was in the film, which is actually a test, was the demons, when we first meet them planting hair plugs. And so we decided we'll make the faces very bas-relief in the underworld, very much like Picasso heads, but everything else more dimensional. And it was refreshing. It looked really cool. But I also learned that could get annoying for the whole movie, for every character. So we worked with Pablo just to see, well, what could he do dimensionally? It turned out he could adapt his style and to work dimensionally, to not just work in a graphic way. And so ultimately he designed all the characters in the film. Sometimes I would give him reference, an idea. Well, here's this Native American politician. I like her look, and maybe she could be an inspiration for Ms. Hunter. For characters like Raul and his mother, I wanted him to have some sort of Aztec or Mayan features. And so we went to, like, you know, sculptures, things from those cultures as inspiration. Cat was very difficult. You know, your protagonists, when they're humans, they're always the hardest, the straight characters. And Pablo came up with a treasure trove of African masks and things. He sort of collects images and so forth and pointed the way for her look so that she wasn't like any sort of cliche that, you know, but he found a way to create her and found the inspiration for her. So it was a collaborative process, many cases, mainly coming from Pablo or coming from, you know, inspirations, things I'd find, or a blend of this and this. The character of Lane Claxton, in the earliest days of this, I met Jordan in 2015. We started working for it. There was going to be some inspiration of Donald Trump. When Donald Trump ran and became president, we thought, oh, that's a bad idea. He'll come after us. And then I thought, well, how about Boris Johnson? And then Boris Johnson ran and became prime minister of England. We felt like this is a dangerous thing. Whoever we plan to caricature becomes. So we kept a little bit of the Boris Johnson, but then made him a very unique character. And then he's voiced by David Harewood, who's a phenomenal British actor, who, you know, helped shape his design as well.
So another one that I'd love to talk about was the design for Ving Rhames' character, which, if I read this correctly, was influenced by pro wrestlers and Barry White.
Yeah, Buffalo Belzer's, you know, he had his own journey from the original short story. He was originally very different. I mean, a giant, but he was originally Bub Belzer, redneck of darkness. That didn't survive into the modern thing. So he evolved, and I think it was my idea that I thought of like Barry White just relaxing in a giant hot tub, wearing his sunglasses, being sort of sultry and soothing. But that evolved as well. I mean, what's probably most left over from that are his glasses. Those are Barry White glasses. And Ving has a phenomenal voice, and it's rich and deep. But also the pro wrestler element kind of came in. For him to be a little more bombastic, but very vain. He's a very vain man. He definitely cares. He seems to care more about his hair than his own children. But maybe he doesn't, as you'll find out if you see the film.
And another character that would be fun to talk about is Siobhan, one of the students at Cat School, who, as I understand, she had some influence from the character Cher in 1995's Clueless.
Yeah. Early on, there's those three girls, Siobhan, Sloane, and Sweetie. I wanted them all to be foreign-born because if anyone actually visited this school, Rusbank Catholic girls, they'd see it was all run down and they wouldn't send their kids. So they were these girls and all the students, all they know about is the reputation and the brochures, and they come to the school. Originally the girls were gonna be a little more like traditional mean girls. And one of the principals, this very talented producer artist Ian at Monkey Paw, said, well, maybe they don't have to be just regular mean girls. And I thought of Clueless and actually how appealing she and her friends are. And that became sort of a guidepost that these girls don't have to be jerks. They just have to be kind of ignorant and naive. They're intelligent. And they're trying to do the right thing. All they need is a little education, and Kat kind of leads the way. They also have, like Raoul, they have a good feeling about Kat. something that she herself doesn't have at the time, but they have a sense that she's the best thing that's happened to the school in a good while. Anyway, getting away from the more typical mean girls to this other approach was very liberating. I really love those girls, all of them.
What's your favorite scene in the film and why?
I can't pick one favorite scene. I have to mention a few. I'd say I think the ending, I think that Kat has, because of her ability to show what the future is going to be, and she's learned she can change the future, but she's able to share the good future of herself, her new friends, and the town with her parents right before they die, that they get a sense that them coming back to life had a great impact on their daughter. And then Wendell Wilde, who you think, you know, how talented could they be? They present their design for the Dream Fair, which will be the Scream Fair. And it's amazing and it's beautiful. It's like, what? Those jerks? They made this? That combination of a projected good future, losing the parents, and then this preposterous idea of the best afterlife upstairs or down. That's a scene I really love. It was very hard to get the balance on that. And then there's a couple of runner-ups. I like Kat in the redemption chamber, facing her demons, facing the shadow monster. It was stylistically, it was quite challenging. It was, how many iterations of storyboard. It took many, a lot of time to figure it out and get that right. I have to mention a couple more. I think I love Kat meeting, being dropped off at the school and meeting those three girls, and Raoul very much. Just this clash of cultures. I love when the nuns come and take her away to meet Father Vest. And, you know, I'd say the very first time we go to the Scream Fair and go on tour and see the souls of the danged and what they're faced with, which is never-ending rides. You know, the worst roller coaster, the worst Ferris wheel, the worst teacups in existence. So that's too many scenes, but I love them all.
There was so much to see after I finished watching the screener the first time. I just immediately went back and started again, to be honest.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, I'd say the first time is overwhelming for a lot of folks. And the second time, you'll get it a lot more. I think you'll follow it a lot more easily.
Well, I'm going to mention a couple of fun facts for the curious viewers. Kat's childhood address is 237, and as I understand it, that's an homage to room 237 in The Shining.
You might be right. I'm not sure I want to give away the Easter eggs now, but you might be in the right neighborhood there.
Is The Shining a favorite of yours?
Oh, it's a favorite of myself and many people who worked on it.
Many of us.
Yeah. It holds up. I mean, that's the thing. It, like, you can still watch it again and again, and it works remarkably well.
And speaking of holding up, did I see Jack Skellington in this movie?
Well, technically, that might be illegal, but you might have imagined you saw him maybe more than once.
One other topic I did want to touch on is, I know this is not a new topic for you and for many in the animation world, but outside of the animation world, it seems that message that animation is film, it's not for one thing. It can be used to tell all sorts of stories, is a theme that I'm hearing more frequently. Would you like to talk about that topic?
Yeah, it's always about what's successful and let's do more of the same so that... going back to Disney films, Walt Disney actually took some chances, in Fantasia. There's kind of experimental segments in the film, and it wasn't overall a very successful film, I guess. So he did less experimentation after that with occasional bits like Pink Elephants on Parade in Dumbo was as psychedelic as you can get. And but there's a formula and there's brilliance. Brilliant films have been made within that formula, but it's still very limited. I think everything that DreamWorks, Pixar, Disney Animation, Illumination make, and there's big range of topics and stories and all, but in my mind, it's all really one thing. It's all pretty safe and doesn't take any strong chances. I think Zootopia was actually one of the most breakthrough subversive films to ever come out of Disney because it dealt with real issues of racism, real society, and it was done in a beautiful, subtle way. But that's like the exception. The fact is, you know, you look around the world at other types of shows and anime or Miyazaki or even Adult Swim or FX, you know, this little demon. I mean, people are taking chances. They're going hardcore with politics, violence, sex. They are telling any kind of story, and if it's told well, it can be successful. But for feature films, American animated feature films, it's still, you know, people say, yeah, that's for the kids. And they watch it 20 or 30 times, and yeah, they try to make it good enough that the adults don't get angry about it. But I'm sick and tired of it. So, you know, with a film like Wendell Wild, I'd like to think it got rated PG-13, even though it's not very intense. Is drinking hair cream substance abuse? There's very little foul language. There's no sex, but it got the PG-13. And honestly, I'm hoping kids as young as, well, the brave kids as young as 6, 7, 8, 9 will watch it. But I also hope that older people can too and think of it as a film not just for kids. I just hope other people take bigger chances. The people that can afford to take the larger chances, do. I'm very heartened by the fact Chris Meledandri, who is a very talented man. He set up a new studio. He's had a lot of success. Despicable Me, I thought was really, really clever, really good. But he's just set up an adult animation division with Mike Moon. That's a huge breakthrough. Mike Moon's super talented. He was running that at Netflix. His stuff was some of the best on Netflix. So that's the first sign that all could change. If Chris Meledandri's comfortable enough in his success to take this sort of chance, that makes you feel good. And animation can just be film, and it can tell any kind of story.
Henry, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the film.
Thanks so much. It was wonderful to see you again, Carolyn.